Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, another look at The Police, featuring Marlon Wayans, Malcolm X, David Rovics, and a reading from historian Jill Lepore. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's time to take another look at The Police, a complex look. We'll be aided by historian Jill Lepore. In a recent article in The New Yorker magazine, Lepore explores issues like, where do the police, as we know them today, where do they come from? Why do we have police forces instead of constables or watchmen or the militia or the posse comitatus, as in the past? And most pressingly, why do our police forces have such a bad and ongoing history of brutalizing people of color? Jill Lepore is far from a radical, but she makes a point that has radical implications. In America and England both, the history of the police forces is intimately, inextricably connected with the history of slavery and the control of slaves. In America, that's true in the North as well as in the South. Also on the subject of the police, we'll hear from comedian Marlon Wayans. And for some more radical perspectives, we'll hear from singer David Rovics and the late Malcolm X. Let's start with Marlon Wayans.
It's weird, man. It's weird, you know, this whole thing with the cops, man, because, you know, as a black man, you have a, you know, especially a grown black man, I have a weird relationship with the cops, man. Like, on one hand, I'm a black man, so I'm like, fuck the police. And on the other hand, I own property. You know, if somebody comes and breaks my house, I'm not calling the Crips. Yo, Crips. Can you send little JJ down? Oh, he's here already. My bad. I mean, here's the thing with the cops, though. I mean, being a cop's a hard job, man. It's a hard job, man. I mean, honestly, I don't think they pay cops enough. I don't think they pay police enough. And you get what you pay for. But here's the thing, man. Whenever the cops gun down an innocent black man, they always say the same things, man. It's like, well, it's not most cops. It's just a few bad apples. Bad Apple. That's a lovely name for murderer. It's like, how'd they get that one? Bad Apple. That almost sounds nice. I mean, I've had a bad apple. It was tart, but it didn't choke me out. Here's the thing. I know it's hard being a cop. I know it's hard. I know that's dangerous. I know it is, okay? But some jobs can't have bad apples, okay? Some jobs, everybody got to be good. Like pilots. You know? American Airlines can't be like, you know, most of our pilots like to land. We just got a few bad apples that like to crash in the mountains. Please bear with us.
Marlon Wayans. Funny, but not very hard-hitting. You'll note that he's actually supporting the bad apples theory that he is gently mocking. Get the bad apples off the force, he suggests, and everything will be hunky-dory. Jill Lepore, though, gets much closer to the roots of the problem and points out some of the corruptions of the system itself. Her article appears in the New Yorker issue of July 20th, 2020. Here is a substantial chunk of the article. Its title is The Long Blue Line, Inventing the Police. The killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis cannot be wished away as an outlier. In each of the past 5 years, police in the United States have killed roughly 1,000 people. During each of those same years, about 100 police officers were killed in the line of duty. One study suggests that 2/3 of Americans between the ages of 15 and 34 who were treated in emergency rooms suffered from injuries inflicted by police and security guards. 2/3. That's about as many people as the number of pedestrians injured by motor vehicles. Urban police forces are nearly always wider than the communities they patrol. The victims of police brutality are disproportionately black teenage boys, children. To say that many good and admirable people are police officers, dedicated and brave public servants, which is, of course, true, is to fail to address both the nature and the scale of this crisis and the legacy of centuries of racial injustice. The best people, with the best of intentions, doing their utmost, cannot fix this system from within. There are nearly 700,000 police officers in the United States, about 2 for every 1,000 people. This is a rate that is lower than the European average. The difference is guns. Police in Finland fired 6 bullets in all of 2013. In an encounter on a single day in the year 2015, in Pasco, Washington, 3 policemen fired 17 bullets when they shot and killed an unarmed 35-year-old orchard worker from Mexico. 5 years ago, when The Guardian counted police killings, it reported that, quote, in the first 24 days of 2015, police in the U.S. fatally shot more people than police did in England and Wales combined over the past 24 years, unquote. American police are armed to the teeth with more than $7 billion worth of surplus military equipment, offloaded by the Pentagon to 8,000 law enforcement agencies since 1997. At the same time, they face the most heavily armed civilian population in the world. 1 in 3 Americans owns a gun, typically more than one. Gun violence undermines civilian life and debases everyone. A study found that, given the ravages of stress, white male police officers in Buffalo have a life expectancy 22 years shorter than that of the average American male. The debate about policing also has to do with all the money that's spent paying heavily armed agents of the state to do things that they aren't trained to do and that other institutions would do better. History haunts this debate like a bullet-ridden ghost. Jill Lepore continues. The history of the police begins in England in the 13th century, when maintaining the king's peace became the duty of an officer of the court called a constable, aided by his watchman. Every male adult could be called upon to take a turn as watchman, walking a ward at night and, if trouble came, to raise a hue and cry. This practice lasted for centuries. Aversion endures. George Zimmerman, when he shot and killed Trayvon Martin in 2012, was serving on his neighborhood watch. The watch didn't work especially well in England. Quote, "The average constable is an ignoramus who knows little or nothing of the law," Blackstone wrote. And the watch didn't work especially well in England's colonies. Rich men paid poor men to take their turns on the watch, which meant that most watchmen were either very elderly or very poor, and very exhausted from working all day. Boston established a watch in 1631. New York tried paying watchmen in 1658. In Philadelphia, in 1705, the governor expressed the view that the militia would make the city safer than the watch. But militias were not supposed to police the king's subjects. They were supposed to serve the common defense, waging wars against the French, fighting native people who were trying to hold on to their lands, or suppressing slave rebellions. The government of slavery was not a rule of law. It was a rule of police. In 1661, the English colony of Barbados passed its first slave law. Revised in 1688, the law decreed that Negroes and other slaves were, quote, "wholly unqualified to be governed by the laws of our nations," unquote. And it devised instead a special set of rules for the good regulating and ordering of the slaves. Virginia adopted similar measures, known as slave codes, in 1680. Here is a passage from Virginia's slave code. "It shall not be lawful for any Negro or other slave to carry or arm himself with any club, staff, gun, sword, or any other weapon of defense or offense, nor to go and depart from his master's grounds without a certification from his master, mistress, or overseer, and such permission not to be granted but upon particular and necessary occasions. And every Negro or slave so offending, not having a certificate, as aforesaid, shall be sent to the next constable, who is hereby enjoined and required to give the said Negro 20 lashes on his bare back, well laid on, and so sent home to his said master, mistress, or overseer. That if any Negro or other slave shall absent himself from his master's service, and lie hid and lurking in obscure places, committing injuries to the inhabitants, and shall resist any person or persons that shall by any lawful authority be employed to apprehend and take the said Negro, that then in case of such resistance, it shall be lawful for such person or persons to kill the said Negro or slave so lying out and resisting." That's from the Colony of Virginia's Slave Codes, 1680. In 18th century New York, a person held as a slave could not gather in a group of more than three, could not ride a horse, could not hold a funeral at night, could not be out an hour after sunset without a lantern, and could not sell Indian corn, peaches, or any other fruit in any street or market in the city. "Stop and frisk, stop and whip, shoot to kill," says Jill Lepore. We continue reading from her article, The Long Blue Line. Then there were the slave patrols. Armed Spanish bands had hunted runaways in Cuba beginning in the 1530s, a practice that was adopted by the English in Barbados a century later. It had a lot in common with England's Posse Comitatus, a band of stout men that a county sheriff could summon to chase down an escaped criminal. South Carolina was founded by slave owners from Barbados. The colony authorized its first slave patrol in 1702. Virginia followed in 1726, North Carolina in 1753. Slave patrols married the watch to the militia. Serving on the slave patrol was required of all able-bodied men, and patrollers used the hue and cry to call for anyone within hearing distance to join the chase. But neither the watch, nor the militia, nor the patrols were police, who were French, and they were considered despotic. In North America, the French city of New Orleans was distinctive in having la police. These were armed city guards who wore military-style uniforms and received wages. An urban slave patrol. Here we will pause for this week our reading of Jill Lepore's article on the history of police and policing, The Long Blue Line, published in the New Yorker magazine, July 20th, 2020. We'll pick up the article again in our next new installment. Even as I speak, in my quiet provincial town of Manchester, Connecticut, in April 2021, some citizens are marking the one-year anniversary of a very questionable police shooting of a local Hispanic man with mental health problems. The victim's name is Jose Soto. Soto was an ex-convict. 1 year ago, police came to Soto's mother's house to arrest him for failing to keep in contact with his parole officer. From the basement, Soto shouted something about a gun. The arresting officer called for help. A regional SWAT team was dispatched. At one point in the arrest, the SWAT team saw an object in Soto's hand, identified it as a gun, and opened fire, killing Soto. The object turned out to be not a gun, but a cell phone. There turned out to be no guns at all on the premises. The state's attorney did not bring any charges against the officers, concluding that they had acted reasonably. Okay, this is not the most egregious recent case of police homicide. That award perhaps goes to Officer Derek Chauvin's public asphyxiation of George Floyd in Minneapolis, as Floyd was lying on the ground handcuffed. Still, the Soto killing is bad enough. Soto's death recalls Jill Lepore's critique of the unwisdom of sending, quote, heavily armed agents of the state to do things they aren't trained to do, and that other institutions would do better, unquote. Dispatching a couple of psychiatric social workers would have produced better results than deploying the Regional Police Special Forces Commando Unit. An interesting question is, why do small towns in Connecticut even have a police SWAT team? David Rovick's song, Say Their Names, was necessarily incomplete some months back when it was released. It is now even more incomplete. The song is about police murders of people of color. We heard a bit of the song a few months back, but ran out of time. Let's hear the whole song now.
Jacob Blake was walking to his SUV. Alton Sterling was selling DVDs. Eric Garner had just broken up a fight. Breonna Taylor was asleep in the middle of the night. Tamir Rice was playing in the park. Elijah McClain was out walking after dark. Dominique Clayton was sleeping in her bed, where she was shot by a cop in the back of her head. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Walter Scott was driving to a store. Betty Jones was answering her door. Philando Castile was driving home with his girlfriend. Anthony Hill was naked on the grass when he met his end. Edsel Ford was walking in his neighborhood. Michael Brown was blown away just standing where he stood. Kendra James was shot to death at a traffic stop by yet another unaccountable killer cop. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Atiana Jefferson was playing a video game with her little nephew, gunned down just the same. Oscar Grant was celebrating the new year, handcuffed when the shots rang out that everyone could hear. Eric Reason pulled into a parking spot. Not long after that was when he was shot. George Floyd was just shopping in a store. Micah Xavier Johnson thought he was still at war. Say their names. 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 Say their names.
David Rovix and Say Their Names. All my life, people, especially people of racial minorities, have been protesting and denouncing, quote, police brutality, unquote. White people, by and large, were spared this brutality, and we used to dismiss such charges as grumbling by hoods and thugs. Most of what we knew of the police we learned from watching fictional TV shows like Dragnet, Perry Mason, and the FBI. We knew the police were all Eagle Scouts, right? In the 1960s, TV news footage showed the forces of law and order brutalizing peaceful civil rights protesters. Even so, few of us questioned the goodness of police forces themselves, certainly Northern police forces. The problem was, quote, Southern sheriffs, unquote, we said, as though Sheriff Bull Connor was just a bad apple. We heterosexual Protestant white people were pretty myopic. Many brown and black people knew better, Malcolm X among them, knew that Officer Friendly on the corner was in fact very different from Sergeant Joe Friday and Lieutenant Tragg on TV. For me personally, the spell was broken at the 1968 Democratic Party convention, when Chicago's finest removed their identifying badges and rioted, smashing the heads of hundreds of peaceful Vietnam War protesters outside the convention center. Smashing the heads of middle-class and working-class young white people like myself. Chicago 1968 was a shock to my system, as Mom would say. I think white people are less myopic now, thanks in part to the video cameras in every smartphone, and thanks to the camera's owners who document the brutality at some risk to themselves. It's harder to dismiss claims of police brutality in the face of video evidence recorded by ordinary bystanders. Here's Malcolm X speaking of police brutality back in the early 1960s, back before many of us were listening. Malcolm is not buying the bad apples theory. Malcolm insists that corrupt and racist policing is just a part of a corrupt and racist system of justice, politics, and economics.
Almost every statement that Commissioner Murphy makes would give you the impression that he's encouraging the police, rank-and-file policemen, to take whatever method or measure is necessary to hold the Negroes in check. He feeds the type of statistics to the white public to make them think that Harlem is a complete criminal area, that everyone is prone toward violence. This gives the police the impression that they can then go and brutalize the Negroes or suppress the Negroes or even frighten the Negroes. Whenever something happens, 20 police cars converge on one area. This doesn't frighten Negroes. So it means that someone is either misinforming Commissioner Murphy and making him use tactics this year that he would not use 4 years ago or that the former policeman Kennedy would not use. And this force that is so visible in the Harlem community creates a spirit of resentment in every Negro. They think they're living in a police state and they become hostile toward the policeman. They think that the policeman is there to be against them rather than to protect them. And these thoughts, these frustrations, these apprehensions automatically are sufficient to make these Negroes begin to form means and ways to protect themselves in case the police themselves get too far out of line.
We want an immediate end to the police brutality and mob attacks against the so-called Negroes throughout the United States. Yes, a complete end to the police brutality and mob attacks that our people are confronted by every single day, every single week, every single month, every single year across the land. Brother, show me those. You got those pictures? Brother, grab that picture of Brother Ronald. Let me show you what I mean by police brutality and mob attacks. Come over here with that. Here is a man, a Korean vet. This is a black man, a Korean vet. Went to war in Korea fighting for America. Risked his life fighting for America. And came back to this country and was shot down by the white man like a dog. Not some Ku Klux Klansman down in Mississippi. This black man was shot through the heart by policemen in Los Angeles, California. And they are dumb enough to think we have forgotten. Well, Muslim never forget. You don't kill our brother. We don't never forget. You don't shoot one of us and then grin in our face. You don't shoot one of us and then shake our hands and think we forget it. No, we never forget. We'll never forget. Someone has to pay.
And with the strong, clear, and definitely not pacifist voice of Malcolm X, we end this installment of New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again by any means necessary next week. Till then.